Welcome to the Art of Business podcast. My name is Tim Lebrecht. I'm a co-founder of the House of Beautiful Business. We are recording these conversations at the Heimat Museum, the Museum of the Home in Davos, during the annual meeting 23 of the World Economic Forum. The theme is cooperation in a fragmented world. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Jessica Apotheker, who is the global CMO of the Boston Consulting Group, BCG, also managing director and a partner, and the CMO for BCGX, a new practice that BCG, or a new unit, I should say, that BCG just launched in December. Is this your first time in Davos? No, you've been for a few years, right?
It's actually my second. I did the May Davos last year, and now it's my first winter Davos.
Is it different than the May Davos? I heard it was, yeah, it was different.
It's the very, very, very different. First of all, now you have to slip in the street everywhere, which doesn't happen in May. But it's also that I think May was a small edition. There was less people, less conferences, a bit less energy, to be honest. Here it feels very intense and interesting.
So people always speak about the Davos moments. Mm-hmm. So you've been here for a few days now. What have been your Davos moments? What stood out for you? What are some of the topics you find emerging? And well, are there some topics that you feel like are not talked about enough?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of the conversations that we're having is around the state of the economy and what's going to be the economic outlook for this year and how can businesses get ready. So I think that is very high on everybody's agenda. I think actually I have found quite a bit of cautious optimism on that front, which is really great to hear. Because at some point, you know, pessimism is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we would rather have leaders optimistic on that front. That's one. Two is definitely technology, very central to the conversation still. ChatGPT and the buzz that it did and all of the questions of the implications for business. But three, actually stronger than could be expected given what has happened in the crypto world this year. Still very top of mind. Diversity and inclusion, always important in Davos. Talent and how to retain talent and what's going to be the future of work, also very high on everybody's agenda. And for sure, ESG and climate, as expected, stays really high and thankfully so in everybody's conversations. So that has been a bit what I have encountered. Are there things that are not being discussed that I expected? Not that much, I want to say. I think it's pretty much what you would expect in leadership conversations right now.
So let's unpack each of these buckets you just touched upon and start with Web 3.0. I mean, I share your impression that I was actually quite surprised about the confidence of crypto and blockchain-based organizations and Web 3.0 in general. Yeah. Many sessions on that topic, lots of billboards, houses along the promenade in Davos presenting companies. So are we over the Web 3.0 winter? Is there a new confidence? What will remain of some of the enthusiasm and optimism that we saw a couple of years ago? And will we survive this FTX-induced sort of backlash or disappointment? So where are we with Web 3.0, in your opinion?
That's a great question. The way I see Web 3.0 and a lot of the crypto technologies, and especially everything that is blockchain enabled, is that we are still extremely early stage from a technology cycle perspective. The platforms are still really immature. There's a new platform popping up every day, and most of them still struggle technically to just be stable. And in terms of use cases around blockchain, we are just scratching the surface. And some of the bubble that is bursting now was some of the earlier use cases around collectibles and some of the fancier crypto currencies that emerged. However, I think the underlying trends that support Web3 are still super strong. And there's a general belief in the ecosystem that it is going to be the technology of the future and it's going to be our internet experience of the future. And I absolutely support that. I think if you think of what it means for digital identity to be able to go across the internet with a wallet to identify yourself that is totally anonymous and blockchain enabled versus having a personal ID, I think that stays a fundamental trend that people will flock to. So I'm actually in the camp of believing that in the next 5 years, Web3 will become the major dominant platforms we can interact with.
Mm. So there is some concern, of course, whenever there is a paradigm shift that this next wave of technology furthers the divide and it's not inclusive enough. That's also been talked about a lot here in Davos. You did some interesting research, I think, or presented some numbers earlier in a session about diversity in terms of founder teams. Maybe you can talk about that. Be interesting.
Sure, yeah. I think the reason why it's important is because Web3 is such an early stage, we still have every opportunity to shape it in a way that it's going to be diverse and inclusive. And if you look at what happened to Web 1 and Web 2, the diversity and inclusion dimension actually kicked off very, very late. And just arguably when it was too late. And some of the early use cases were really focused on white male. And you think just of gaming, for example, gaming is still really, 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 really gender biased. Now in Web3, unfortunately, if you look at the builders of Web3 today, so the people that are founding startups and creating new platforms out there, it is incredibly not diverse. The percentage of female founders right now in Web3 is 7%. 7%. That is incredibly low. And there's a reason for that is that there's a real funding gap for female founders in this space. If you look at what a female founder, 100% female team is going to raise and what a 100% male team is going to raise, there's a 4x difference in that amount. 4x. It means that a female, all female team raises a bit less than 8 million on average, and an all male team raises 30 million on average. That's a huge difference. And if you look at startups that have raised more than 100 million, the share of all female teams in there is 0%. 0%. And there is an underlying reason for that is that if you look at what female founders are doing, 78% of female founders, when they're creating a Web3 startup, is associated with a guy, which is a very rational behavior based on what I've just described. 74% of male founders associate with a guy. So what we need out there is we need male founders, when they've decided to create a company, rather than taking their best buddy that they know, they should go and find a girl that they can actually create with. That would be a huge difference in the ecosystem. And I actually also think we need to be very data-driven on the topic and count women and report not just on mixed teams, but also on all female teams across the board so that we can track that gap and make sure that it's closing.
Another aspect of the inclusion debate about Web 3.0 is the language. It's the accessibility of the language, which can often be, at least in my experience, be very cryptic, very opaque. So I read a bunch of papers on blockchain and you know, decentralized autonomous organization, and often it gets complex very quickly, and the language almost intentionally seems to be very exclusionary. Is that an impression you share, and would you see management consultancies such as BCG in a role to simplify the language and make it more accessible with the impact that you have, you know, across all kinds of businesses in the world?
Yeah, I think it's a totally fair observation. The language is extremely hard to penetrate. To be fair, that is true of a lot of technologies. I think if you think of the language system around AI, most people don't know the difference between deep learning, machine learning, a lot of that language either. I think the reason why it's an important point for Web3 is because it's going to be a consumer accessible technology, which is not the case of AI. And there is push in the industry to go very fast on the maturity cycle of that technology. Usually technology takes 10, 20 years to mature. And here, because of the level of investment and traction that the technology has, we're trying to go from a very nascent technology to a mainstream technology in very little time. And for that to be inclusive, we need the language to adapt faster than it usually does in a technology cycle. And we have a role there, and every person in the ecosystem has a role. But also, I think, if you think of schools, universities, education, they have a really big role too to be able to adapt faster to what is happening there.
Speaking of language and technology, we need to talk, of course, about generative AI, namely ChatGPT.
Yeah.
It seems like finally AI, which has been sort of simmering and developing and finally had its moment. Everybody's talking about it now. 1 million users, right? In, I don't know, a week or two, like in a short amount of time. How safe is your job?
Well, a great question. I want to say, how safe is your job?
I'm not sure. So we did a little bit of an experiment. We asked ChatGPT to curate our next conference. And actually, the recommendations that came back were remarkable.
Yeah.
And even it even wrote a play, a screenplay for us, or a play actually for one of these sessions we're hosting later. And it was remarkably creative. I mean, you can, after a while, I think you detect, of course, sort of the building blocks and the, you know, the still somewhat reductionist thinking, I think, that reveals itself. But it's very impressive. What do you think?
Yeah, it is very impressive. I think the reason why it's creating so much buzz on AI is actually a pretty bad reason, in that AI has been around, used, and at scale in a lot of processes for a long time. For example, anybody who uses voice recognition and GPS is actually AI-powered to some extent. So AI has been at scale, but so far it has actually threatened mainly blue-collar jobs, in that it was really about automation, process redesign, and so a lot of the concerns were not in the intellectual professions or skill set. ChatGPT, all of a sudden, is actually something that can automate some white-collar intellectual job. That means what journalists do, what professional services do, what creative designers do. And so that's why there is a buzz. There is a buzz because there's interest. There's also a buzz because the people that drive some of the opinion all of a sudden feel threatened. So the first thing I think we need is we need to take a very holistic look around AI and its impact and challenges. I'm actually a real technology enthusiast and big believer in AI. And I think what it's going to do, it's going to redefine our jobs, yours and mine, in a very meaningful way. But it's not going to replace it. I don't believe in replacing. And in the same way that in reality, for a lot of the blue collar jobs, it didn't replace. It evolved the skill set. And so if I think of consulting, and so this is going to be a bit of a complex explanation, but if you think of the slides that would be generated by a chatbot like that, it actually exists. It's called ChatBCG, by the way. It generates slides. It's really interesting. What's going to be critical is, can rather than relying on the open source technology that everybody's going to have, as a consulting firm, can you develop your own version of this that has a lot of your IP and that is a meaningful asset that you can then leverage that actually makes you better than the others? All of a sudden, we're going to have to compete also on building that type of technology. That's the implication for us. And in reality, in journalism and media, it's going to be very similar. Because if everybody uses the same open source algo, then there's going to be nothing interesting anymore, right? So we're all going to have to take that algo and build it and expand it and make it smarter and make it more custom and tailored to what we want to say. And with that, there will still be a lot of richness in what we do.
Hmm. How do we avoid the scenario of this becoming kind of like a park of many walled gardens? You know, because ultimately it's the big platforms, of course, who will then create proprietary AI, such as OpenAI, which started as a nonprofit, is now a for-profit organization, did Microsoft investing heavily in generative AI. So who's going to win the race, in your opinion?
Ooh, I'm not sure I have an answer to that one, if I'm honest. And it's interesting also, because if you had asked me that question 6 months ago, I would have told you that with Web3, actually, all of the big GAFAs and all of these big walled gardens were finally really threatened. Because with the wallet becoming your identity provider and that wallet being able to carry you from platform to platform, all of a sudden, there was a real chance of interoperability of the ecosystem at scale. And so that was what got me so excited about Web3, is that opportunity to actually break all of these walled gardens. Now, ChatGPT comes in and is a potential total reinvention of the way we navigate and use internet. And when an algo is like that, there tends to be a bit of a winner takes all advantage, because a person who's really defined a tech standard will have a very significant advantage out there. So that risk of walled garden that had gone down is now going back up quite significantly. So since my prediction 6 months ago would have been wrong, not sure I can make a prediction now. But I think the one thing I would say is anybody who's in the tech or professional services space should be investing right now in people that are capable of understanding these algos and also to some extent verifying these algos, right? Because right now ChatGPT, if you think about it, is totally non-transparent on its sources, on where there's override, on what it says. Fun example, I asked ChatGPT the other day, what is the ideal shape of a female body? And it answers a super wishy-washy answer. It says, all female bodies are beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it's such an unhealthy question to ask. That's what it says, basically. Which I am very sure that is not the algorithm that came up with that answer. This is an override of a responsible AI layer that you would have also on ethnic questions and things like that. That's totally fair and a good thing. That being said, it's not transparent today. It doesn't tell you where there's override and where it is really the outcome of the analysis and the data. And we can't have that. That's really a huge threat, because tomorrow somebody wants to tamper with the algo, change historical facts.
Yeah.
You won't know. Won't know. And to me, there is not enough thinking on what is the auditing system that we create around these algos, fact-checking, the source of journalism, fact-checking. What is going to be fact-checking around an algo like ChatGPT?
I think there's also the risk that because ChatGPT dishes out truth, facts, in a way that is so convenient, so fast, so conversational, so contextual, that we're even more prone to confusing this with the truth.
Yes.
Even more so than Google search results.
Totally. Right?
So you're in conversations like, okay, that's it, that's it. So it's kind of, I feel like there's a danger of a new solutionism or a new sort of data reductionism that maybe suppresses other, you know, imaginative faculties of humans. Am I too pessimistic?
So I'm going to make a prediction here that may be a little gloomy, though. I actually think what is going to happen is gradually we will start developing algos to audit and check what an algo like ChatGPT does, which by the way, is something that already happens with deep learning algorithms, where to understand what the algorithm has done and why it's done what it's done, we add layers of models that just can interpret the results. I think for ChatGPT, what's going to happen at some point is you'll have auditing or fact-checking algorithms that will plug on top. And there's a very real risk in today's world that is so siloed and clustered from an ideological standpoint, that different currents are going to create their own fact-checking algorithms, and that will compete, and that you'll have different competing fact bases that will clash with each other around that.
So generative AI, of course, is also going to change the way you do marketing from a research perspective, probably the creation of editorial content and so forth. You are very outspoken on the value of data in marketing, or in general, of course, in business. The name of the series is The Art of Business. I was a CMO myself, and I've always sort of struggled with this question of like, how much science is there in marketing and how much of an art is it? How much of an art is marketing? What is still artful about marketing versus this being a completely data-driven performance marketing discipline?
All right, that's a tricky question. So I'm in the camp of people that believe that marketing has now become much more of a science than it used to be. It used to be, when both you and I started, I remember 15 years ago, I was an intern at L'Oreal. It was 100% an art. There was zero science in there. And what marketers loved, and the DNA of marketing, was creativity, ideas, branding, visual design. And that was really a lot of what we used to do. Now, with all of the new touch points and contact points that are actually technology-based, a website is technology-based, an app is a technology-based, advertising technology to actually buy ads, CRM, there's so much technology and data at the heart of consumer engagement and customer engagement that marketing execution has become 100% a science. Now, marketing execution is a channel and activation machine. What you feed into that channel and activation machine is still, in my mind, 50-50 between an art and a science, in that you want a lot of that creativity and that storytelling to stay so, so strong, or your brand no longer has unicity. But at the same time, you want to use a lot of data to understand what you should be talking about, what interests people. If I think, for example, of just an ad creative, very simple one, used to be that you spend, as a marketer, most of your effort in trying to produce that perfect ad, then you would air it, and then you would anxiously wait for the result, right? Now, when you air an ad, that's when you get real information on digital, on how it's performing, and you can tweak it. And so I'm more and more in the camp of saying, don't produce one ad, produce five, air five, see which one performs, and optimize on the fly. And so that softens some of the art part. That being said, a great ad still has a lot of creativity.
Mm. And it's also interesting in that context how you actually structure marketing at BCG, which I understand is sort of in this tandem with a communications lead and then a marketing lead. Talk a little bit more about how you know, the checks and balances and how you cooperate to basically cover the scientific, the artful, the marketing, the brand, and the performance marketing part.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was appointed 8 months ago, and at the same time as my appointment, there was Russell Dubner, who joined us as our chief communication officer for Mendelman. And we sat at the beginning, Russell and I, and thought, okay, so what are we doing? Are we dividing this? And do we have a marketing function and a communication function? And both of us had a very strong belief that the audience, the customers, the people we were engaging with us throughout communication and marketing channels in a seamless way. And that divide is an organizational divide. It is not an experience and journey divide. And so we decided to actually keep both functions super, super intertwined. And in every pocket of capability, one of us takes the lead with the input of the other. And we collaborate across everything. We collaborate across content, social media, website, performance, and trying to bring both visions together to drive the better integrated marketing and comms. That's a very high bar. It's an ambitious adventure for us, but it's for the moment proven to be super effective and super fulfilling.
Do you think that unorthodox setup might help you defy the odds of fairly short CMO tenures, which are still, according to Spencer Stewart, I think it's 40 months on average. So it's increased a bit, I think, but it's still fairly short, which seems really unfair because you don't have enough time to really build a brand, right? What do you make of that the tenures are so short in general?
I actually didn't know that. I should have known before taking the job. No, but maybe. But, you know, I am not driven by that and I don't think like that. What drives me is my own learning, how much I'm going to learn in that tenure. And working with Russell is a great opportunity to learn on things that I don't know as well. And also, I still do quite a bit of client work, working with organizations on their own marketing transformation, and having that hands-on execution experience actually strengthens a lot of my advisory work. So I'm very interested by that synergy that really drives me. And the other thing is I'm really driven by impact. And with Russell, we've had early successes with that model. For example, with the BCGX launch recently. And so that, seeing what we can do when we raise that bar, that gets us really excited.
Perfect segue over to the final topic that I want to cover with you, which is the launch of BCGX. It's a new design and tech build unit within BCG that you launched recently. Yeah. Tell us more about it. Why did you launch it? What's the rationale behind it? And you're also the CMO for BCGX, I understand.
Yeah. So we have a very deep-rooted belief at BCG that, first of all, tech is still super, super high on everybody's agenda, tech and digital. When we survey companies, it's really interesting because 60% of CEOs say they will continue to double down on digital and technology. And there's 70% of them that say that so far the digital transformation has failed. So, you know, it's really schizophrenic to some extent. And so we believe, and I personally really believe into the power of technology, what it can bring to businesses, and that it is still at large an untapped opportunity for most of the companies we can work with. And some of our thinking around BCGX was, when you do a digital transformation, to turbocharge that impact, you need to bring together a couple of really critical components. One, you need a lot of change management. You need to redesign your processes. You need to rethink the way you work in a very meaningful way. And to do that, having a technology asset that you can leverage that makes it real for people in day-to-day life actually turbocharges the impact of that transformation. And for that technology asset to be impactful, it needs to be relatively customized to you, to your company, to your process, but it still needs to be scalable. And so we decided to launch BCGX, which is our tech design and unit capability. We have about 3,000 people in there. And what we do there is we develop custom industrial grade technology assets to support these transformations on the most critical use cases of a company, and hand in hand with BCG's expertise to really turbocharge that transformation end to end. And it's a bit of a magic formula, if I'm honest.
Jessica, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you and get your take on Davos and marketing, marketing leadership, and what BCG has been doing. I would love for you to join us at the Dream, the underlying Dream to be precise, which is our festival this June in Sintra in Portugal, convening 600 people to imagine, reimagine business. And on that note, I want to ask you a personal question.
Sure.
What is a dream of yours?
Ooh. So I have two little girls. Nina is 7, Yael is 5. They're both absolutely wonderful. And my dream is for them to grow up in a business and corporate world that is more inclusive than the one I experienced. And that's why I'm so passionate about diversity and inclusion, is I think I come from a generation of women where when I was younger, I thought it was totally equal and was going to be easy. And my experience was it was not. It was not as much as I thought. And I really want my kids to have an easier time to some extent.
Jessica, thanks very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.